You're listening to the best in Bitcoin, made audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am your host, Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. A quick thank you to Swan Bitcoin for supporting this show and, of course, for making available the best way to auto-buy and auto-stack your Bitcoin savings. And speaking of Bitcoin, we have got a really interesting article that I found on this is Phil's Notes. It's written by Phil Bonello, and this was published towards the end of last year, and I haven't gotten back to it in a while, but it's about the concept of the sovereign individual and how to think about investments in kind of the trends and the shifts that we see in technology with encryption, the internet, with Bitcoin, these sorts of things. And it's such an interesting little read that I really wanted to share it and talk about it a little bit on the podcast. So today's Bitcoin Audible is by Phil Bonello, and it is titled The Sovereign Individual Investment Thesis, Globalization, Digital Money, and Dissident Technology. Information technology alters global power dynamics in a few key ways. One, instant information dissemination reduces commercial and jurisdictional barriers to entry and barriers to exit. This increases competition by facilitating global entrepreneurship. 2. The creation of non-sovereign digital money decreases the power of inflation and taxation. Financial services can also more easily address the global market. And 3. Encryption reduces the cost of protection and decreases the leverage of violence at scale. This leads to the rise of dissident technology. Each of these categories represents a huge shift in society. They present massive opportunities. This post is an introduction into each of these changes and examines the source of user demand through the lens of the following human motivations: acquire, or greed, desire to collect physical objects as well as immaterial ones, like power, status, and influence. Defend, or fear, desire to protect ourselves and our property. Bond, belonging, desire to form relationships. Learn, curiosity, desire to satisfy our innate curiosity. Feel, to escape, desire for sensory stimulus and pleasure. Identifying investment opportunities through the lens of unchanging human motivations is inspired by Bezos's excerpt. Quote, I very frequently get the question, what's going to change in the next 10 years? And that is a very interesting question. It's a very common one. I almost never get the question, what's not going to change in the next 10 years? And I submit to you that the second question is actually the more important of the two, because you can build a business strategy around the things that are stable in time. End quote. Examining shifts in power dynamics helps us recognize overarching trends. Examining human behaviors within each trend helps us understand specific points of investment leverage. While the set of human motivations is constant, the weighting of each changes based on the environment. Quote, the lamb and the lion keep a delicate balance, interacting at the margin. If lions were suddenly more swift, they would catch prey that now escape. If lambs suddenly grew wings, lions would starve. The capacity to utilize and defend against violence is the crucial variable that alters life at the margin. End quote. The sovereign individual. Information technology has altered the balance between the lion and the lamb. It allows us to communicate and coordinate globally. Encryption allows us to store and protect assets against sophisticated attacks. For better or worse, commerce will increasingly be conducted outside the reach of government's protection. This increase in individual power will cause a shift in human behavior from acquire to defend. As the phrase goes, with great power, there must also come great responsibility. Theory of change number one. Globalization is an equalizing force. Instant information dissemination reduces commercial and jurisdictional barriers to entry and barriers to exit. This increases competition by facilitating global entrepreneurship. Almost all information is readily available online. Increasingly, commerce occurs online. Most work can be coordinated remotely. This will likely lead to greater income equality between jurisdictions, but potentially greater income inequality overall. Highly skilled entrepreneurs have unprecedented leverage to outperform, and unskilled workers have unprecedented global competition for work. As someone raised in the United States where wage expectations are high, this idea can be unsettling and unpopular. Competitive wages of remote work overpower jurisdictional boundaries and restrictions. With the diminishing importance on physical availability, the leverage governments have over their citizens decreases. Citizens increasingly become customers, and governments compete for their business. Look no further than the success of Singapore as an example of a highly favorable business environment. There will be a strong equalizing effect that lower-cost jurisdictions and workforces will have on economies. Developed countries may experience uncomfortable periods of deflation. Developing business-friendly jurisdictions will see outsized economic growth. This creates a wide range of investment opportunities spanning all human behaviors. The table below is an example of potential investment opportunities in the corresponding demand sources. Green denotes demand now. Orange denotes demand later. XX denotes the dominant user motivation. Education is an especially interesting sector. A high degree of information asymmetry provided institutions enormous power, a monopoly over reputation, degrees, and thus the ability to charge high prices. But with the transcendence of location and vanishing information asymmetry, education is ripe for change. We're in the beginning stages. Education is expected to grow to a $10 trillion industry by 2030, and the industry would be expected to add close to 100 million teachers. That is a massive resource requirement, and with interest in top-level higher education falling rapidly, we will see a migration to lower-cost, borderless solutions. Further, higher education has been massively subsidized. Using the United States as an example, student loan debt sits at a staggering $1.5 trillion. Government intervention has artificially kept demand for traditional institutions afloat. The progression in educational demand is straightforward. Scalable online programs educate highly competitive workforces at a fraction of the cost. These workforces undercut the wages that were once expected from graduates of traditional institutions. Expected value of traditional education falls dramatically, and almost all learning is driven to more efficient providers. Theory of change number two. Digital money is the foundation for global financial services. The creation of non-sovereign digital money reduces the power of inflation and taxation. It also further reduces friction of global commerce. With the advent of Bitcoin, we saw a major governmental lever begin to dissolve. The follow-on effects are not yet obvious. The fact is, Bitcoin reduces government revenue potential by providing a way to opt out of hyperinflationary forces and by altering taxation enforceability. With digital money, personal wealth becomes more difficult to seize and easier to transport. It further reduces geopolitical borders and allows the cyber economy to flourish without gatekeepers. Bitcoin allows individuals to better defend against inflation, defend against seizure, defend against censorship. As these needs grow, so too will the value proposition of Bitcoin and ancillary applications. This is another uncomfortable idea as a citizen of the United States. The USD seems infallible, but when growth slows, the first button nations push is the one that turns on the printing press. It's happening as we speak. After weak attempts to tighten, money supply is rapidly increasing again. This view is not reserved only for Bitcoiners, libertarians, and gold bugs. Ray Dalio's recent writings, Here and Here, links provided, echo this sentiment. We're seeing the beginnings of a fintech stack built to support natively digital money and exploit the benefits it provides. Currently, exchanges, custody, mining, and borrowing or lending services are the leaders. Bitcoin businesses can be separated into demand now and demand later. Speculation, or now. Exchanges, funds, data providers, brokerage services. Defense, later. Decentralized exchanges, self-sovereign custody, trustless payment products, fiat to Bitcoin on-ramps. Right now, the dominant use case for digital money is speculation, the drive to acquire. Secondary demand comes from users defending against inflation, asset seizure, taxation, or regulatory hurdles, the drive to defend. Interestingly, the products that have most effectively delivered on speculative and censorship demands are BitMEX, Binance, and USDT. No wonder they have been so successful. Exchanges are a good case study for thinking about market demand. Decentralized exchanges, or DEX, were all the rage in 2018, but have seen limited adoption. We won't see adoption of fully decentralized solutions until there is greater demand for regulatory arbitrage and dissent. That demand isn't present today, but with growing capital controls, we will see migration to non-corruptible services. Along similar lines, solutions that facilitate trust-minimized onboarding, custody, and commerce will become more important. I'm particularly interested in watching adoption trends of on-ramps like Local Bitcoins, payment services like OpenNode, BTC Pay, and Zap, and key management systems like Casa. With these products, financial services companies will finally be able to target billions of users around the world. Jill Carlson hits the nail on the head. Tweet by Jill Carlson. With the internet, the addressable market for so many companies went from local, millions, to global, billions. What got left out? Financial services. Locked in by jurisdictional regulations and currencies, crypto, for the first time, unlocks a global market for financial services. Theory of change number 3. Encryption enables dissident technology. Encryption reduces the cost of protection and decreases the leverage of violence. This enables significant power to move from the center and toward the margins, free markets. See this post, with link provided, from the FBI General Counsel on why encryption is such a powerful force and how governments are unable to stop it. Continued recognition of vulnerabilities in infrastructure and applications, and the development of viable replacements, will lead to demand for an anti-fragile, censorship-resistant, borderless web stack. I had been struggling to find a proper description for these crypto applications, and I think Maya Zahavi captures it perfectly with Dissident Tech. Tweet: Dissident tech is going to be a thing sooner than any of us realize, and it fits right into crypto for the most part. End tweet. Further, aggregators and public service providers are honeypots that have become targets for attack because there is an asymmetric reward profile. Attack on corporation, a large reward with strong security. Attack on an individual, small reward with strong security. The power of encryption. However, this switch from centralized systems to distributed systems requires a fundamental shift in human behavior. We are used to outsourcing our security and protection. This is why we see limited adoption of crypto applications. It's not just a scalability issue. It's a demand issue. Our environment hasn't yet warranted a behavior change, but the undercurrents are growing. More specifically, the demand for these distributed technologies comes from two angles. Cost efficiencies. Removing middlemen can decrease predatory rent seeking. This is a marginal benefit and not powerful enough to force a switch. Defensibility. These systems have the potential to be anti-fragile, safer, and censorship resistant, or dissident. These are 10x improvements. Consider the ability to run applications on a personal encrypted single server, Urbit style. Store your data locally and get paid to share it through homomorphic encryption on an open market without the potential for data duplication. This would transform the incentives of internet companies who currently rely on data mining. It gives a huge amount of power back to the users, and it would generate countless new business models. The incentives to force this behavior change aren't here yet, but they are coming. Conclusion. Online education will continue to equalize workforces. Wages in developed countries will trend lower, while wages in developing countries will grow. Digital money is the catalyst for truly global fintech companies. The regulatory pushback will be intense, but futile. There is a growing need, but not an imminent demand for dissident technologies. We have to focus on incentives and user demand. The sovereign individual popularized many of these ideas in 1997, and they have begun to take hold. We are still in the early stages. I think the tipping point will be in the next 10 years. This framework only scratches the surface, and I plan to follow up with deeper research into each section. Thanks to Nathaniel Whitmore, Ryan Yee, Christian Kazmarchik, and Jimmy Kofsky for feedback on this piece. All right. So, let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then I want to talk about the sovereign individual investment thesis and how to think about the coming future from I thought that was a great piece on how to think about the future from an investment perspective and weigh it on the motivations of the static and never-ending motivations of human individuals. So again, let's hit our sponsor real quick and we'll jump right back in. So, all right, let's dig into Phil's piece here. Of course, I'll have the link to his Twitter account and also to the blog so you can check it out. He's got a lot of other great work up here that I have yet to really do a lot of digging into, just because somehow this was the piece that linked me to that blog. But I'm definitely going to be checking it out, particularly if the plan is to dive deeper into these topics as time unfolds, because this was just a really great piece, and I love the topic about the sovereign individual and the major developments that are happening to really change the dynamics and the payoffs of violence and centralized control, which is really what is at the heart of this. And this is why this isn't one shift. This truly is like three shifts in the same era, essentially. That could have massive impact on the underlying dynamics of centralized violent institutions, governments being our prime example here. But I want to get at first education, just because I think the pandemic actually has caused such an acceleration in that. And just the general dissemination of information is so fast now. We are so much more connected all across the world that I genuinely think it's a matter of time. It'll probably be a generational thing that the younger generations will grow up without that deep attachment that people that did not have alternative sources of information do have. I think it's kind of similar to how like our generation or like my generation, the people in, you know, the 30s and late 20s and maybe even early 40s, know how to deal with spam and scams and stuff. Like, they can identify that on the internet much better. And I think generally nowhere near is as much or as well as the younger generations will have. But they also see alternative sources of information as potentially legitimate. Like they can better assess something that is complete idiocy versus something that has a strong backing and a real argument behind it. I mean, not to say that, you know, we all agree and we all come to the same conclusion, like that's ridiculous, but just in the general sense that we have better scanners, I guess you could say. There's better internet literacy for making sense of things in this environment. And I think that will only increase as more generations just exist on the internet in general, that, you know, experience the flood of crap on Twitter and YouTube, and they go down conspiracy rabbit holes. Like, because that's one of the benefits that I think I had, is that, like, so many of the conspiracies, or, you know, what's the infinite energy arguments and, like, YouTube rabbit holes and stuff that, like, I went down that those roads in, like, high school. So, like, after, you know, coming up empty at the end of, like, these loops, it just kind of, you know, it just kind of became this fun thing where I realized that, you know, I was gonna have to really, really dig and really find something concrete before I ever came to any sort of conclusion that there was truth behind any of this. Like, I think my excitement about that when I was younger and then coming up with nothing to show for it was really a big part of my development in realizing what was bullshit and what wasn't. And obviously my ability to navigate between the two, whereas I think older generations who are now just finding the internet kind of have to go through that same maturation phase, and they're already too far, like, settled in their thinking that it's just so much easier to trap them. They're not as mobile and they're not as adaptive as somebody who is, you know, in middle school or in high school or something. The younger generations are ready to expect huge changes in their life anyway that will alter their perspectives. The, you know, people in older generations really don't have those major, there's no significant change left at those stages. You know, after you get out of college and get into careers and stuff, changes are much more gradual. And I don't mean that in the sense of, like, life changes. I mean that in the sense of, like, who you are as a person, and kind of your ideology. There's something I heard, I don't know, sometime back, that it's like your late 20s, you know, mid to late 20s, that that's the time where you become the person that you're generally going to be the rest of your life. Change can obviously come after that, but all of the major significant, like, hormonal and development changes that really push on your reality have already been, you've already been through those. So just in general, as literacy improves in that, I think the impact and the adherence probably really of the schooling system, which I think is the source of, you know, our nationalism and our extreme monoculture of thinking, I really think we're watching the cracks of that foundation, and it's being accelerated just in the fact that at the same time that all these alternatives are popping up, and at the same time that that's happening, the price is becoming so inflated, and the perceived value, while the real value is decreasing, the perceived value is increasing steadily. And I think we're reaching that unsustainable position, and so many of these things are coming to head all at once. Like, the quote, actually, that I thought was really great from this was, quote, "The progression in educational demand is straightforward. Scalable online programs educate highly competitive workforces at a fraction of the cost. These workforces undercut the wages that were once expected from graduates at traditional institutions. Expected value of traditional education falls dramatically, and almost all learning is driven to more efficient providers. So the fact that you have both the incredible increase in alternative education avenues and in a global market, no less, one where this maybe even traditional institutions aren't even available to those people. And then the fact that remote work is possible at the same time, and you can actually get your this balancing of wages across countries. There is a huge bubble in education that is ready to pop. It is primed to pop. And it is based on, and he talks about it in this article, is that they basically had a monopoly on reputation, that if you did not have their degree, that you were perceived as useless or valueless in the market economy. And that has been a filter for a very, very long time. And that is falling away. In fact, we really have seen that fall away already. It's just, I genuinely think that the kind of the lagging indicator, or I guess you could say the lagging market, is in the deeply political markets, those that are most connected to like the legal infrastructure and, you know, finance. Like, all of these things are deeply political these days, and they're so connected to the financial apparatus, the central banking system, and getting cheap money, subsidies and special privilege from the government. Like, these things prop up and are kind of the last vestiges of this system. But I think it's falling away around them already. But really, when the shift gets kicked off, I think it's going to look a lot like the Medallion disaster that occurred in New York City and the other, you know, major taxi cities, with the rise of Uber and Lyft and these other things. Is that you had these massive debts to, you know, purchase $100,000, $200,000 medallions to be a taxi in New York City. And then in just a handful of years, that the rug is completely pulled out from underneath them, because you can work for Uber or Lyft without this massive debt. And when that monopoly was finally broken, everyone who had invested in that medallion, everybody who had invested in the old system, were left holding the bag, because they had massive debts and now had to compete with the Uber drivers and the Lyft drivers that could easily pay or easily get paid a wage that did not have to nurture a $100,000 debt. You know, they didn't have the medallion problem. And I think we're going to see the same thing in education, is that they had this monopoly on reputation, essentially, and that is broken, and it's becoming increasingly more obvious, particularly in places like the tech industry, which is, you know, ever-growing and expansive and genuinely merging with every other industry slowly. I mean, just, you know, hell, even like energy mining and stuff is going to become, I feel like, far more efficient by its merging with tech. I mean, Jesus, look at Upstream Data, you know, installing Bitcoin miners on one of the most mechanical things in the world, you know, attaching it to these, you know, big giant oil wells, whatever the hell those things are called, to, you know, flare off, to burn off the natural gas that was going to just be wasted, and now it's being used to mine Bitcoin. And these new systems are going to add to the efficiency massively, and that is, tech is going to find its way in there too. But they are literally dropping one by one the requirement to have a college degree. They want people who are capable, and even some forward-looking companies that, you know, not necessarily in tech, but there's an increasing portion of the economy that's beginning to see college degrees, particularly kind of pointless college degrees, like, as a deterrent, as something to actually stay away from. Because if somebody has a lot of school debt and a degree from some sort of major school, God forbid it be something like generic, like a communications degree or something similar, like that's a mark against that person's ability to make a good investment decision. You know, no fault of their own, in my opinion. They're pushed into it from high school. Nobody has a clue what they're doing at high school. And if there's a general expectation that you're just going to get $200,000 in debt and you're going to go to the best school because that's the way the economy worked 50 years ago, and obviously it must still be true today, well, then what the hell do you know? You know, you don't, it's not like they try. It's, you're literally shoved into it. You're not even out of high school by the time they're like, okay, let's make sure you sign on the dotted line and get you into, you know, make sure that all of your future productivity goes to a good university, that you become their slave for the next 80 years. It's really kind of disgusting and evil, in my opinion. But anyway, so the reason it would be a negative, particularly in an economy where remote work is so much easier, is that now you're having to pay for a worker who thinks their perceived value has gone up a lot, which very likely it hasn't, because higher education has been so divorced from the job market for so long that much of it is not, it's kind of irrelevant. It's genuinely become high school 2.0 for a lot of people. So now you're expected to pay that person more, while that person also needs more money in order to service their debt. And they probably have no, they could very well have no initiative, like no kind of independence. They might not even be able to do anything unless you have an explicit set of instructions, because that's what they've been doing for the last 22 years. If they didn't have an explicit set of instructions, like, there's no creativity. It's like, it's memorization. You know, the whole, our schooling system was designed around getting people to work well on an assembly line, but it doesn't work in an adaptive, creative environment where you want people to take initiative and know their role and their value and, you know, how they can help out a company or a team of people. Arguably, our schooling system is antithetical to the very idea of what is most valuable in our economy today, in a general sense. Like, I know, you know, schooling isn't ubiquitous, but it's damn near. But in that, you have, you're going to see in developing countries, you know, an explosion of, I mean, hell, I've seen it, like the ability to get low cost labor from, you know, people who speak half English, like Fiverr and Upwork and these things. I've been using them. I've been using them for this podcast and for, like, our network and everything, just because, you know, you offload an enormous amount of time and frustration just in hiring somebody else to do something for you. And these people have these skills, and they can get them for direct skills that, like, people actually need. And you can go in there and you can look at the market and you can be like, wow, this is what people are really paying for. This is what people need. You can get programmers of all sorts on these platforms. And you don't need to go to school to learn programming. Some of the best educational materials are literally online. I mean, it's programming, for crying out loud. Of course you're going to be able to find stuff online. And certifications, direct certifications, and an actual portfolio, a project that you have built, is 1,000 times more effective than a degree. In fact, if you end up with a degree and you don't have a portfolio, like, nobody's going to take you. The portfolio is the important thing. The certification is the important thing. They want to know that you can do, not that you can regurgitate. Luckily, you know, most education in coding doesn't really have that problem. But also, someone who has an excellent portfolio and a handful of certifications, a handful of really reliable, like, good reputation certifications, can easily compete with someone who has a degree from a powerful, awesome, super important higher education, university or something. Like, that is not where the value is. And it's explicitly those major tech companies that are dropping the need to have a degree altogether. Google, I think it's not even, like, as part of their requirement anymore. And there's a handful of others. I can't remember exactly which ones they are, and I don't have time to look it up. I'd even heard that some have stopped requesting that information at all. They want to see that you can do something, that you can build something, and that's it. And that's just in education, right? Like, there's still, like, just the nature of encryption shifts the asymmetry between, you know, violence and defense, or attack and defense, on a massive scale. And that's really part of the core of the sovereign individual thesis of or the book, if you've listened to it, is about that, and about being able to protect value in cyberspace, so to speak, or hide it in cyberspace, the ability to maintain privacy, the ability to maintain sovereignty in the digital sphere, and that the only method, there's no blanket method of attack or control with strong encryption systems. You have to go at it individually, which means your cost, the two little things, like if you're going after like a big corporation, you're going after a whole population or something like that, is you have very, very high reward and then also a very decently high cost. Whereas if you have to go at everyone at the individual level, you have very low reward. You know, you have individual reward. You know, the whole value of going after a corporation or some giant network or something is the fact that you're getting everybody at once. So as attacking the individual, you have incredibly low reward and you have incredibly high cost, because the ability for that individual to defend themselves, or at least to prevent you from getting said wealth or knowing about said wealth, is increasingly in the individual's favor. And now add to that a system like Bitcoin, where literally the value itself is in the digital sphere. Like that's groundbreaking. You know, that's a huge shift that cannot be just simply dismissed. Like this is historic on a 1,000-year scale as to what it does to the payoffs. And kind of like he says in this article, I think it's something that will gradually unfold over time, but this will have profound impacts. And it may be something where it takes generations worth of time, because they said the demand isn't there yet for, you know, these distributed systems and these dissident technologies that will protect people, that they don't see the need to defend. But that is coming. That pressure is building. And as it does, and people realize the value of these things, the adoption will happen quick in the younger generations. And if that's simultaneously happening, where, you know, the reputation of the education system and that political class is also becoming, reaching its point of unsustainability, where trust in governments and in mainstream media and that monoculture narrative of, you know, we're all in this together is breaking apart, and where people are no longer see the mainstream media as a source of truth, but as one of the same clickbait bullshits that they get everywhere else. And they can start to, whether it manifests purely as distrusting the old, the legacy narrative, I guess you could say, or if it's in actually landing on something new or finding an alternative that they find as the truth, whatever it is, it's still breaking that monopoly on thought. And then, of course, with the globalization of the markets and the ability to find remote workers, and therefore the bridging of the gaps and the ability for fintech to fit in that role, where fintech is the one thing that hasn't been able to bridge that gap. But now we've got an independent programmable currency to tie all of this together, one that can be made into, you know, stacks of, like, protocol stacks on everything that you could possibly imagine, including all forms of dissident technology that you can think up. I mean, all of this coming to a head at the same time, and these three huge fundamental shifts in the power dynamics and the spread of information and knowledge, like all of this happening at the same time, is unbelievable. Like it will take time, because these are those huge trends. You know, these are societal shifts. They take 50 years. They take a century. You know, the printing press, the effects of the printing press literally took almost an entire century. It's like from, you know, 1500 to 1600-ish. But the effects were monumental. You know, it reshaped the world. It redefined religion. It the literacy rates exploded across the planet. I mean, just nothing was left untouched. And this is what we are in right now. We're you know, 20 to 30 years into steps one and two, and Bitcoin has landed, and now it's coming onto the scene. And together, all of this stuff, it's going to rapidly accelerate from here. And in 20 to 30 years, the world will be unrecognizable, in my opinion. I mean, I think we'll see borders change. We will see countries change. We will see monetary systems shift dramatically. It's just going to be a different world. And everything that we thought we knew is just not going to be the case anymore. The way to invest, the way to, you know, prepare for a career, I'll think that all that stuff is turning on its head. Like my brother-in-law or whatever, like he's just now getting to the end of his high school career, and I think the absolute wrong path is going into college. There are only a tiny sliver of things in which that is actually the right decision to make, and that it's an incredibly short-term payoff. The part of the economy and the part of the industries that are still concerned about that will not live nearly as long as the debt that comes out of that. You know, it's like taking on a 20-year loan for a house that's maybe going to be around for 7 years. So it's just really interesting to think about this from an investment standpoint, is to look at what we can expect to see in the future, weigh it via the, you know, the basic human motivations, and how can we see the world changing? And it just a great article. It's a great article. I wanted to share it with you guys, and I hope you like it. You know, long story short, Bitcoin's going to change the world. What? Who knew? I hope you guys enjoyed that one. I'm out. It's getting late today. Don't forget to follow Phil. I will add his Twitter tag. In fact, let me find it real quick. I know, like, nobody actually goes and checks the show notes, so I want to get his like actual tag. I'll read it aloud, and then therefore you can remember it, and types it into your Twitter. So his tag is Phil, Phil, J, Bonello, Bonello. Hopefully I said that right. But yeah, don't forget to check him out, and don't forget to check out Phil's notes, that blog. I am definitely going to be keeping that one in my lineup, because this was just a really cool perspective that I thought was fun to dig into. With that, thank you guys so much. Don't forget to sign up for Swan Bitcoin for your Bitcoin savings plan if you don't have it yet. And there's some really fun stuff coming. I don't want to jump the gun and announce it before, you know, anything actually gets in the works. But there's some really fun stuff coming. So follow at Swan Bitcoin. That's Swan with one N, not my name, on Twitter, so you don't miss it. And of course, if you haven't started your Bitcoin savings plan, do so at swanbitcoin.com/guy. And, you know, give them a shout out. Give them a shout out for supporting this podcast, for keeping Bitcoin Audible available for you guys. With that, I love you all. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. We are Bitcoin Audible, baby. And until next time, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.